Good evening, everyone. I'm Steve Aronson. A very special night on Folk Classics. I'd like to welcome Dick Boak, recently retired from Martin Guitar after 42 years. Welcome, Dick.
Well, hi there. You can call me Grayson tonight after that song. I love hearing those old songs. It's a really very nostalgic, and they sure do stand up, don't they?
Let's see, that's 50 and 60 years ago.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Dick Boak, as I said, just retired from Martin Guitar after 42 years. Among the many roles Mr. Boak had at Martin Guitar, he managed the artist relations. He was heavily involved in many of the signature guitar projects at Martin and director of Martin's Museum and Archives. And now, in retirement, he's immersed in art, music, travel, and organizing archives for a local guy many people might know from this area by the name of Mario Andretti. How did that happen, Dick?
Well, it was pretty much of an accident. I was just enamored by the fact that Mario had had a wonderful little show on CBS Sunday morning, a little 15-minute feature about his life, and I thought it was so nice, such a nice story. And I got one of my books, my archive book, and I signed it over for Mario, and I figured, what am I going to do? Am I going to FedEx it over across the street? Because he lives right across the street from me. And that seemed silly, so I called his office, and they said, well, he's sitting right here. Well, you know, why don't you drive it over? They opened the gate, and I came over, and he gave me a great tour of the house, and we got talking, and he said, you know, I know you've been at Martin for many years. What do you do over there? And I said, Museum and Archives. And he said, well, look at this. I want to show you something. He pulled out this drawer, thousands of photographs in the drawer, and they'd never been scanned or organized, and same with videos. And so I offered to train his assistant, Amy, but she let me know after a couple of hours that she didn't have time to do it. She was really busy, and she wondered if I would. So this was concurrent with my retirement, and it was really just a perfect situation, and I'm working on it at my leisure.
Folk music to auto racing.
That's right.
Interesting segue. You were with us on Folk Classics many times at the beginning when we first started the program several years ago. We actually shared the microphone via telephone with Bob Shane. You and I and Bob Shane did a Lehigh Valley Discourse, I think it was. So it's been a while since you've been here, and the thing that kind of spurred your return to Folk Classics was an article that you wrote in the September-October edition of Acoustic Guitar Magazine that says, Kingston Trio, a lasting legacy. In terms of writing the article, before we actually delve into the legacy itself, what prompted you at this point in time to take a look at that?
Martin was involved with Acoustic Guitar Magazine ever since their inception. This goes back a couple of decades at least. And so I've been very good friends with the owner, publisher, David Lusterman. After my retirement, he had pitched me several times as to whether I wanted to become a regular writer for the magazine. I was not really interested in doing a regular stint, but in fact, he was the one that asked me if I'd be willing to write an article about the Kingston Trio. It was a topic that certainly interested me, and I had a kind of a plan in my head of what I wanted it to be. And so it wasn't my decision, it was a request from the magazine.
The Kingston Trio has been around for a long time. The article uses the word a lasting legacy, and the way I, after reading the article, the way I see it, it goes into two different directions, the legacy itself. One, of course, is the incredible contribution the trio made back in 1958 to the revival, what they called then the urban folk revival, what I call the golden age of folk. So that's one way the legacy applies. And there's also the long association with Martin Guitar, and we're going to get into that as well. Before we delve into each of these legacies, what can you tell us about the current status of the Kingston Trio?
Well, you know, the really have to acknowledge the very first Kingston Trio with Dave Gard, Bob Shane, and Nick Reynolds. That's really what I think of as the Kingston Trio. And of course, when Dave Gard left the trio and John Stewart filled in, they kind of had a second coming, the Stewart years. And after their dissolve in that format, they went through almost a dozen different changes over the years. The purpose of all these different versions of the trio were simply to extend the legacy of the original trio and the original songs, in my opinion. And the songs were so strong and so influential on an entire generation of musicians, including, you know, Bob Dylan. Some people say that Dylan wouldn't even have existed without the trio.
In terms of where they are right now, I guess I did read online today that the current trio is comprised of Mike Marvin, Tom Gerallington, and Don Maravich. We haven't received any promotional material from them. They don't seem to have a CD out yet, so we can't really comment. Are you aware of any of those folks?
You mentioned to me that one of them is from the Limelighters or had filled in. Yeah, had filled in from the Limelighters. And, you know, I've read a little bit about them. The basic story is that Bob Shane controlled the licensing for the trio. Bob was licensing the most recent group that you and I are familiar with, which was George Grove, Bill Zorn, and Rick Daugherty. And they were really a great group. I think they were doing their version of the trio for about 12 years, at least. What happened is, as Bob Shane has become older, his need for financial security became tighter, and he was offered to sell the licensing of the trio to Josh Reynolds, who's Nick Reynolds' son. And there was, you know, from my understanding, a fair amount of money involved, and it was important for Bob, and he did it. So it, in a sense, it kind of pulled the carpet out from underneath George Grove and Bill Zorn and Rick Daugherty. And I was saddened by that because I think they were fervent supporters and ambassadors and lovers of the music. They were very passionate about the trio and about keeping the legacy alive, and I think they did a really, really good job at it. Well, the new trio that formed quickly, from my understanding, it imploded and required some replacements and some reorganizing, not once, but I think twice, to get it into its current form. And I haven't heard the new current version, but I'm a little bit saddened by the whole goings-on, but I guess that's what happens in the music business.
Mike Marvin, I think I read, is related somehow to Josh Reynolds. They grew up together.
An uncle or something? Something like that. Or
cousin, I believe, yes. We're going to be talking about the two aspects of legacy, the history of the trio, how they got started, and the John Stewart trio. And then before you leave tonight, Dick, we're going to hear the Daugherty, Zorn, and Grove trio.
Great.
But we're going to start off with the music this evening with Bob Shane and his signature song, as well as a couple of others that you know well, Dick. On Folk Classics, I'm Steve Aronson here with Dick Boak on WDIY 88.1.
Scotch and soda, mud in your eye. Baby, do I feel high, oh me, oh my. Do I feel high?
These are the times that try men's souls. In the course of our nation's history, the people of Boston have rallied bravely whenever the rights of men have been threatened. Today, a new crisis has arisen. The Metropolitan Transit Authority, better known as the MTA, is attempting to levy a burdensome tax on the population in the form of a subway fare increase. Citizens, hear me out. This could happen to you.
Well, let me tell you of the story of a man named Charlie on a tragic and fateful day. He put 10 cents in his pocket, kissed his wife and family, went to ride on the MTA.
Well, did he ever return? No, he never returned, and his fate is still unlearned. He may ride forever neath the streets of Boston. He's the man who never returned.
Charlie handed in his dime at the Kendall Square station, and he changed for Jamaica Plain.
Thank you.
WDIY 88.1. Well, that was a number of rousing songs. That was the original Kingston Trio with Bob Shane, Nick Reynolds, and Dave Gard, with Bob Shane's signature song, Scotch and Soda. And you also heard MTA and A Worried Man. I'm Steve Aronson in the studio with Dick Boak. We are discussing an article entitled The Kingston Trio, A Lasting Legacy. And that was quite a legacy to begin with, wasn't it, Dick?
Those four songs are really kind of the quintessential Kingston Trio. And, you know, the Scotch and Soda, I remember Bob Shane telling me that Frank Sinatra told him that only Bob should sing it because nobody could sing it better. And you have a story about Tom Seavers and the song?
Well, they acquired the song Scotch and Soda. Dave Gard was dating the sister of baseball legend Tom Seaver back then. Tom wasn't quite a legend yet. Anyway, they had a singing night at the Seaver home. Their parents were playing the piano. Seaver's parents were playing the piano. And Scotch and Soda is one of the songs they played, which they claim they heard at a bar. Dave Gard picked it up and arranged it, and Bob sang it, and the rest is history. But that was Bob Shane, Nick Reynolds, and Dave Gard, the original trio. What can you tell us about how they got together?
There's basically Hawaii and California. Shane grew up in Hawaii, and he wasn't a very good student. He started playing music early on. He played a tenor guitar like Nick. I guess what happened was, and I always have to refer to my notes because there's so many iterations and things that happened, but I guess Bob met Nick in Hawaii and started to sing together. Is that what you remember?
Dave in Hawaii and Nick in Menlo,
that's right,
Menlo
that's
College.
Right. They went to school together, Bob and Dave. They had a certain chemistry together, and this is so tough, isn't it? You know so much more than I do about the trio.
I know it from reading the article.
So Bob enrolled in Menlo Park, and Dave enrolled in Stanford. And there they met Nick. I guess Bob met Nick, had a certain chemistry of humor with Nick as well. There were various iterations. Dave started a little band based on calypso music, and eventually that band broke up. Dave and Nick were looking for a person to replace the two people that left, and Bob was the logical choice. So they were organized by a manager who had heard them play at a local club. His name was Frank Werther?
Werber.
He really whipped them into shape. They took a year. They got their act together. I think Dave Gard played a huge role in acquiring songs, coming up with ideas, and they practiced and got their act together, recorded their first album, and it just was a smash hit.
Kingston Trio, the first album, and included Tom Dooley, among other songs.
And that was Tom Dula, wasn't it?
Didn't sound so good in music, musicology.
Yeah, right.
They were together for about 4 years, and Dave Gard decided to leave the trio. Can you amplify that a little bit?
Dave was basically unhappy with the direction that the trio was going. He wanted to take it in new directions, and Nick and Bob really were happy with the success that they had achieved and wanted to not change the formula of their hits in their music. So Dave wanted to move on. And another thing that happened is that because Dave was searching out most of the material that the trio used, he was getting 40% of the royalties on the music that he sourced, and Nick and Bob were getting 30%. And that was a fine arrangement until one of the songs that was in the public domain actually got licensed. The music publishing went for 40% to Dave, and the other two didn't really appreciate that. And it started a little bit of bad feelings with the original group. So eventually Dave Gard left the trio, and, you know, they had a very aggressive tour schedule all over the world. They had contractual arrangements with the record companies for more albums. They really needed to scramble pretty quickly and come up with a replacement for Dave. They went looking, and two of the applicants were pretty interesting. So a very young Roger McGuinn, 19 years old, was pitched on the idea, and I guess he was just too young and didn't want to do it.
As it turns out, John Stewart wasn't that much older, but he was older, and he did have, I think, some prior relationship with the trio. But another more interesting.
Yeah, Rod McEwen, who was.
I can't even imagine.
He was a poet, really, and his music was really poetry read in kind of a, I don't want to degrade him in any way, but kind of a syrupy, sappy love poetry. He was very popular at the time. Well, it just was not a great fit. What was a great fit was John Stewart. And John had been a fan of the trios. He knew all the songs. In fact, he had actually written a couple of songs for the trio that they had recorded. And the chemistry was right, the humor, the musicality. And he was also good looking. He fit right into the band. Put a striped shirt on him, and they were ready to go.
Well, this seems like a good time to listen to three of the songs that were very popular from the second trio, Bob Shane, Nick Reynolds, and John Stewart. Here on Folk Classics, I'm Steve Aronson with Dick Boak, and you're listening on WDIY 88.1.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? Young girls pick them, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn?
He rode easy in the saddle. He was tall and lean, and at first he thought nothing but a streak of mean could make a man look so downright strong. But one look in his eyes and you knowed you was wrong. He was a mountain of a man, and I want you to know he could preach hot hell or freezing snow. He carried a Bible in a canvas sack, and the folks just called him the Reverend Mr. Black. He was poor as a beggar, but he rode like a king. Sometimes in the evening I could hear him sing. I got to walk that lonesome valley. I got to walk it by myself, or nobody else can walk it for me. I got to walk it by myself. If ever I could have thought that this man in black was soft, had any yellow up his back.
Some people say I'm a no-count, others say I'm no good. But I'm just a natural-born traveling man, doing what I think I should. Oh yeah, doing what I think I should.
And I don't give a damn about a greenback, a dollar. Spend it fast as I can, or a wailing song and a good guitar. The only things that I understand, oh boy, the only things that I understand.
WDIY 88.1. In that last set, you heard the second successful iteration of the Kingston Trio. After Dave Gard left, John Stewart joined the trio.
John Stewart wrote the song Daydream Believer for the Monkees, a huge, huge hit.
If I could fly, need the wings.
Daydream Believer. The other thing that I wanted to mention is Where Have All the Flowers Gone, you know, paved the way for, or should I say, the trio recorded the song before maybe the more popular hit by Peter, Paul, and Mary.
There's an urban legend that says the trio traded Where Have All the Flowers Gone to Peter, Paul, and Mary for Lemon Tree, but fact or fiction, not sure. Anyway, so that was Stewart with Bob Shane and Nick Reynolds, and you spoke a little bit about both of those trios sounded great, of course, but there's a slightly different sound.
In the studio, the trio really pioneered the acoustic recording sound. My understanding of it is that there was an engineer named Voyle Gilmore, a producer for Capitol Records. He experimented with this idea of double voicing. So it wasn't tracking. They weren't overdubbing themselves, but they were using the same vocal track twice and maybe offsetting it by a very, very small increment. And it creates a fuller, richer, deeper more powerful sound. You know, some of these things are taken for granted now with recording technique, but the trio paved the way. The other thing that I'm interested in general, is the whole notion of the singer-songwriter, the acoustic guitar and the singer-songwriter, the notion that you could pick up a guitar and write songs and be successful. So I think the trio really drove that whole notion home. Of course, their songs were often traditional covers of older folk music, but their influence certainly paved the way for an entire generation of acoustic guitar players.
When they split up in 1967, they had six successful years, again, riding the crest of the golden age of folk. The Beatles came along, and I believe there was still one point in time when the trio actually sold more records than the Beatles did.
And didn't the Beatles actually credit the trio a little bit?
They did.
Yeah.
They did. And anyway, 1967, they went their separate ways. Anything to say about that?
Well, I think, you know, that time period, and we watched the Beatles break up. A lot of the bands broke up during this time period, and I think there was a kind of a movement toward individuality and solo careers. You know, it's not easy touring with a band, and the musicians get tired of it. They also make a lot of money sometimes, and it's nice to spend some of the money. So I think they just had enough. So Shane went out on his own. Nick Reynolds effectively retired. Dave Gard was doing different projects, and John Stewart actually collaborated with Stevie Nicks of Fleetwood Mac to produce and record a duet called Gold, which was a huge, huge hit for them. But, you know, the request for trio music continued, a clamoring of sorts, and it wasn't long before Bob Shane tried to reacquire rights from his manager and group that had the licensing rights. Bob eventually purchased those rights and began licensing it out. In fact, Bob toured with different versions of the trio early on and then kind of set it free in George Grove's hands with a number of different iterations of the band.
We're going to listen to the last one we know with George Grove.
You know, George was one of the musicians at Opryland, and Martin Guitar had a bluegrass theater at Opryland, which was very popular with guests. And George was a regular, performing many shows a day, and really just a veteran, great, great musician. And so I think a vital, vital member of the group, and next to Shane, the longest-running member of the group.
Well over 40 years.
Yep.
I want to give you some time to talk about the other part of the legacy, which is Martin Guitar's association with the trio itself. But before we do that, I want to play one more song by the trio. This is the George Grove, Bill Zorn, and Rick Daugherty trio, the last one that we've heard. This is George Grove and Bill Zorn and Rick Daugherty with a song written by John Stewart, the Kingston Trio, circa 2016. On Folk Classics, Steve Aronson here with Dick Polk. That was the George Grove, Bill Zorn, and Rick Daugherty trio with a song written by John Stewart back in the 1960s called The Road to Freedom. Steve Aronson here on Folk Classics with Dick Polk. We are discussing the lasting legacy of the Kingston Trio, which is also an article in Acoustic Guitar Magazine in the September-October edition. And the other part of the legacy, in addition to the music, was a long association with Martin Guitar. I saw a quote in the article that said, "Martin and the trio, the factory that the Kingston Trio built." React, Mr. Volk.
All of the members of the various trios were very proud of that fact. I had an associate at Martin. His name was Bill Bush. I had brought him in when I was running the advertising department to assist me with ad concepts. And Bill was a huge, huge fan of the trio. And when we started to have some success with signature models, the first of which was Eric Clapton, Bill immediately jumped on me and said, we've got to do something with the Kingston Trio. You know, they were so impactful, so important, and everybody constantly reminds us that the Kingston Trio's success caused a four-year backlog, backorder situation on D28 Martin guitars, and that's the reason why the new Martin guitar factory at Sycamore Street was built. So we went ahead and did an addition of three instruments, the Bob Shane D28, the long neck banjo, and Nick Reynolds' little four-string tenor guitar. These instruments were sold as a set only. It was the 25th anniversary of the trio, and we made 25 sets. They were successful, and people really wanted to order more guitars. So we collaborated again with Bob Shane later and did a Bob Shane model, a D28 with a double pickguard. And then we did a Nick Reynolds model of the four-string tenor. And we actually did a Dave Gard 0021. So many different projects that involved the trio. Of course, I was really fortunate to become friends with Bob Shane and his wife, Bobby. I knew Nick Reynolds very well, and Nick's wife and Nick's son, and got involved with Gretchen Gard, Dave's widow. You know, very, very special to have those connections and connect really to people that had such an impact upon me in my childhood. It was really the first music that I loved. Well, I have to say Elvis Presley too, but really the Kingston Trio started it all.
Well, thank you, Dick Boak, for joining us tonight on Folk Classics. I'm going to actually send you off with one more song. This is a song that is very meaningful to me, and I don't know why, but I love all the Kingston Trio's music, but this particular song, maybe it was because I was headed off to college or coming back from college. It was just, when I heard it the first time, it really touched me. So, again, thank you, Dick Boak, for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's listen to, this is again the Shane Reynolds Stewart Trio on Folk Classics on WDIY 88.1.
Golden Utah Valley, and I watch the rivers gently gliding. I wave my hand.